This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is film director, writer, and actor John Sayles. Sayles is regarded as one of America's most promising independent feature filmmakers. His first independent film, Return of the Secaucus Seven, takes place at a reunion of former 60s activists. His other films are Liana, Baby It's You, and his latest, The Brother from Another Planet, which is about a black extraterrestrial who lands in Harlem. At a time when movie costs have soared, Sayles has proven he can bring in a movie at well under $1 million. He learned the art of low-budget movie making while writing screenplays like Piranha and Battle Beyond the Stars for B-movie master Roger Corman. Sayles doesn't condescend to the B-movies that helped launch his career because he has a genuine affection for B-movies and genre films.
There were a lot of those movies that I enjoyed as a kid. My criterion for taking a movie on as a job to write the screenplay for it, if I'm not going to direct it, is basically, is there a movie that could be made from the subject matter that I would like to see? So when I approach a movie like Piranha, I always say, well, what kind of this kind of movie did I ever like? And so I'd go back to something like Them or The Return of, the Body Snatchers or Invaders from Mars or something like that. And I said, oh, boy, I really liked those movies when I was a kid, and then I'll see them again. I'll say, I still like those movies. Can I make this into a movie like that if I'm going to work in this genre? I think movies just like fiction have room for a lot of different kinds of things, and one of them is just pure entertainment kind of movies, that are more entertaining if you care about the characters, but even if the characters are sort of secondary. I mean, there's almost a tradition in horror movies of thin characters and bad acting. Sometimes you like the movie despite the thin characters and bad acting, and if you can flesh the characters out a little bit and get a little better acting in them, you like them even more.
In those scripts, did you put in any in-jokes or film jokes that you thought people would get and really enjoy?
Actually, I think most of the film jokes are put there by the directors, Joe Dante and to a lesser extent Louis T, because he doesn't put quite as many in as Joe does. But a lot of times that's the director who's just sort of sees something and says, oh, why don't you hold a copy of Howl during the werewolf movie or something like that. I'll put jokes in there that are almost only to entertain myself. In Alligator, I had, there's a character early on who you never meet who's eaten by an alligator down in a sewer, and he's a sewer worker, and I had him named Ed Norton, which is the name of the character on The Honeymooners who works in the sewer, but you never hear his whole name. You just hear that his name was Norton, and later on you hear that his name was Ed, and if you're really paying attention, you get it, but it was mostly to entertain myself while I was writing it.
Did you learn any cost-cutting devices that you've been since applying to your own movies?
Basically, what I got to be on the set of Piranha, I got to talk to the directors who worked on the other pictures I wrote there, and I learned a lot about what costs money and what doesn't, what's are hard costs and what are sort of flexible costs. Things like the raw stock is a hard cost. The equipment rental is a hard cost. Lodging, the time that you take to shoot something, moving the camera, those are flexible costs. You can actually still make the picture and not move the camera so much if, in fact, you have a story that can stand not moving the camera that much. You can shoot for 4 weeks instead of eight if, in fact, you think there's any way that you can get it in the can in 4 weeks. I basically got an idea about what costs money on a set and how to get in your priorities so that when I've sat down to write things that I knew I was going to finance or that we were going to make for very little money, I've been able to think of the script of, okay, what can we do well for very little money? And what is just going to cost more than we can possibly afford, and we'll have to do it, a quarter of what it could be, because we just don't have the money to support that idea or that scene. And so I've often rewritten scenes thinking, how can I get the same effect within the movie and the same emotion out of the audience, but not set it in this place or do it in this way that's going to cost us so much money?
Is there an example?
In Brother from Another Planet, there's a scene where the men in black, who are these intergalactic bounty hunters, show up, and I wanted them showing up at Port Authority bus terminal. The idea being they don't come from outer space. They've been here for a long time, and this is sort of their beat. We checked out how much Port Authority was going to cost, and I had to alter the scene because we just couldn't afford to shoot there. So instead, we took some sound in Port Authority and actually shot on some escalator stairs in a bank late at night where we could get in for almost no money. And then put the sound there so you feel like you're seeing a close shot of a couple guys who are in a huge bus station. You know, that's sort of a technical way to get around it. But very often it really does mean, okay, I got to get the brother from another planet from Ellis Island to Harlem. He's got to cross the river somehow. What's the easiest way to do this? I can have him sort of jump on a ferry boat. Can we afford the ferry boat? No, we can't afford the ferry boat. So we'll have him see a ferry boat. We'll hear a splash. The next thing we'll see is him on something, which in fact is the boat that took us out to Ellis Island and brought us back. But there he is on a boat in the Hudson. And if we're very careful about what we show, it can look like he's on the ferry boat. You can work around things and sort of get a lot of the same things. There's certain things that just wouldn't, that you can't make for very little money that need some size.
But like the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, you know. but Roger Corman was fond of saying you can make any picture for any amount of budget. It will just look different. If it looks too much different, it's not going to work.
Why did you want to direct? After writing screenplays, did you think that, you could do a better job with your own work than you saw other directors doing with it?
I had actually always wanted to direct. Writing, directing, and editing really seemed like parts of the same process to me. I always feel like the writing is the first draft, the directing is the second draft, and the editing is the third draft. So my main reason to get into screenwriting alone was to get to the point where I could direct my own stuff, and that lately that seems to be the surest way to get directing work. Either to have enough money so you can become the producer and hire yourself as the director, which is one way to do it. The other way is a lot of people: Larry Kasdan, Paul Schrader, Walter Hill. A lot of the sort of newer directors came up through the screenwriting ranks, which is not the old studio way, where people came out of the trailer department or the montage department or, from theater or whatever, and writers rarely got to direct things. Lately, people have been able to write a couple screenplays, have one be a big hit, and then say, oh, you can have my next screenplay if you let me direct it. And a few people have even been successful in sort of coming up with a story that everybody wants to do and tying themselves to it as director on their first time out. So it was always, it wasn't that I was disappointed in how my screenplays were turning out. It was always something that I wanted to do both.
The first film that you directed was Return of the Secaucus mm-hmm. 7, which was about a group of people who were entering their 30s who mm-hmm. used to be good friends in the 60s and were having a reunion. Do you think that the 60s is a subject that the studios have never really handled very accurately in movies?
Yeah, to a certain extent. They've gotten little bits and pieces of it. Easy Rider, which wasn't a studio movie, caught some of the spirit of the time. Certainly, it was a very popular movie among people who were in college or that age back then. And then the studios ran off and made 100 bad copies of it, 100 bad, campus movies and drug movies and stuff like that. And they never really quite got it. But it's such a, even within that time, things weren't monolithic. There were so many different facets to that one of the problems was they just sort of looked the cover of Life magazine and said, oh, hippies, or oh, drugs, or oh, revolutionaries, and that's all they did. And they never recognized the diversity of the people, the fact that most college students even weren't that political. They didn't even go to the big marches or anything like that. They just sort of watched from the sidelines. That it was a matter of there were more people than usual getting involved in those things, and they were getting a lot of publicity, especially considering that they weren't that huge in number compared to the amount of people in college or even the amount of people that age who were of draft age at that time.
A lot of people assumed that it was a very autobiographical film and that you were someone who had probably undergone a transformation in the 60s and mm-hmm. was trying, like the people in your movie were, yeah. to hold on to those ideals. Was there any truth in that?
It's probably one of my least autobiographical films. I'd say in some ways Baby 2 is much more autobiographical. I mean, that situation, that high school situation, is a lot more familiar to me than, you know, the one that the people in the Secaucus 7 are. Secaucus 7 is definitely based on people that I know and know of and you know, like. But I came to politics and to, you know, being in college from a very different direction than a lot of them did. I was very suspicious of politics in general, not just student politics, when I was in school. And actually, I'm sort of less pessimistic and cynical than I was when I was younger. In that way, it's not very autobiographical, although I'm very familiar with those people in that time.
In what ways, maybe it's you autobiographical?
Well, Amy Robinson, who brought me the story, went to Trenton High School in about 1966, and a lot of her experience went into that. I went to a very similar high school in upstate New York, very melting pot kind of high school, 2 years later. You know, I graduated in 68. We both went to sort of allegedly classy, liberal arts colleges and had to make that adjustment during about the same time. We both went from situations where we were really in the 50s to the late 60s, you know, like in 1 year, and had to make that kind of adjustment of, Jesus, what's happening to the world? So I was actually more familiar with the people and more of the things that happened in it were things that I really had seen or done or whatever, whether it was from the male or the female perspective, because, you know, even when I do something autobiographical, it's not necessarily in only one character who's in the movie. So that took in more of my own experience. One of the nice things about working with Amy on that is that she could really tell me what was going on in the girls' locker room and in the girls' conversations, because high school was a place where the male and female, experience is very different. You know, it's really two different closed societies. And now and then you'll see a boy and girl walking hand in hand, and they aren't even talking that much. You know, they really don't know that much about each other's world. So she really had that perspective, and I had more of Sheik's perspective and knew what was going on in the boys' locker room and in their heads. And it gave us a nice kind of overview of the whole experience and of both characters rather than having it just be one character's story or the other's.
That's the only film that you've done so far that's been backed by a studio.
Yeah.
Did it hurt your ability to make decisions and be independent while you were directing? Did you have a lot of squabbles with the studio?
Not while I was directing. During the editing period, we had a lot of big fights over the final cut. I think finally what happened, and we ran into this problem when we were first trying to sell the story to studios, was that studios at that time were just sensing. They had a whiff of this rising genre of the teen sex comedy, and most of the studios that turned it down as a story, including 20th Century Fox, who originally had it was developed there originally, wanted it just to be a high school movie and not to go on to college and all that serious stuff about them growing up. They wanted it to sort of stay sort of a nice, at the most bittersweet kind of romantic sex comedy set in high school. And to us, the whole point of the movie was that they went on to college and that they had to grow up and you know, things had to change and they had to realize things about themselves. And I think what happened is that after they funded the movie in this kind of roundabout way in which Paramount sort of arranged a bank loan for the company that made the picture, so it wasn't a Paramount picture until it was done shooting, then they appeared, they bought the picture from the bank, and then they were the studio of record, and they could say anything they wanted. So they really weren't present during the casting. They weren't present during the shooting. And during the editing, I think by that time they had decided, well, maybe this whole college thing isn't such a good idea, so let's cut down on that and emphasize the first part of the film. And that was not what I wanted to do at all, and it wasn't the script I had given them in the first place. So we had quite a few battles over the final cut, and eventually was the cut that I wanted, but not without a lot of bad business in between.
What power do you have? You know, how do you make use of whatever power you do have in
the,
an argument?
Yeah, the power
like
that I had in that was sort of Gandhi-like power, you know, to throw gasoline on yourself and immolate yourself publicly. The only power that I had at that time, I was in the Directors Guild and I was in the Writers Guild, which I'm still in. And in both of those guilds, there is contract language that says that if you don't like what happened with your picture, you can take your name off it and put a pseudonym in place. So I was actually taken off the editing of the picture for a month while they did their own version of it, because we were disagreeing that much and I wasn't going to do what they wanted me to do with it. And I made sure that I got as much publicity as I possibly could, and I just kept telling them, I'm not bluffing. I'm really going to take my name off this thing. What you want me to do with this thing has nothing to do with the original concept of the picture, and I think it's making it worse, and I think you're not going to make any more money. So basically, I had only the power, sort of like Gandhi did with Britain, is if you have an entity who cares about their image in the world, and at that time, Paramount cared about their reputation as not being a studio who would step on some poor little independent director and take his picture away from him. You have the power, if you're willing to stick it out, to embarrass them. And that's the only power you have. You have nothing contractually if you have the usual director's contract that says you have final cut or anything like that. And so I just kept saying, look, I'm not going to say nice things about this picture if I think you've wrecked it. I'm not going to put my name on it. And it's going to be a very public kind of mugging if this happens. And finally what happened is they did their own cut of the picture and test marketed it. And it didn't market any better than the cut that I had been working on had marketed. So I think they finally just sort of shrugged their shoulders and say, well, it's not going to do good financially either way, we might as well skip the bad publicity and give it back to this guy. And so I got to cut it the way I wanted to. They didn't exactly kill themselves distributing it. I think they just felt like, if we push this movie, we're just going to lose more money than we already have. And so let's cut our losses and just sort of put it open in a couple cities so we can make the ancillary sales. Which is pretty much what they did. So I've since talked to distributors who had to beg for the picture and some who begged for it who didn't get it. So it had a very, very limited run theatrically.
I noticed your next movie after that was another independent mm-hmm. film. Did you decide after that experience with Paramount to stay away from the studios if you could?
I think it was a mutual decision. I think the studios decided to stay away from me and I decided to stay away from them. The Brother from Another Planet was a movie that we actually made because we were trying for about a year to raise money for this other historical film I want to make that will cost between $2 and $3 million if we ever get it off the ground, set in West Virginia in the 1920s. And the money fell through at the last minute. We were casting people and stuff like that. And I was sort of bummed out about that, even though I sort of never really believe the money's going to come through until, we've gone through this so many times with the other pictures. Both Baby It's You and Leanna were on and off a million times before they finally happened. So I just said to Peggy Reiske and Maggie Renzi, the producers of the West Virginia film, would you like to produce another really low-budget film because I've got some money in the bank? Because last year, I wrote 5 movies for other people as well as writing Brother from Another Planet, and I have this idea, and it's, set in Harlem, and here's the basic story. And they said, well, it sounds pretty wild, but sure. So they started producing. We wanted to shoot it before winter, before there was snow on the ground. And I wrote the movie while they were already producing in about a week. Basically, it was one of those things where I just wanted to do it. We'd been messing with studios for years, trying to get financing for the other pictures, and I just didn't want to hear their opinion. I didn't want them to tell me if I would only write a part for such and such an actor, they could do it, or this or that or the other thing. I knew I had enough money to get it in the can, and I could make enough money doing more screenplays to get it through the laboratory process. So why bother with those guys if I didn't have to listen to it, and go through all that stuff? Because I wasn't intending to change anything anyway, so why get into the debate, which we'd been doing for a year on this other picture, if in fact we didn't need the money in the first place? So we didn't even bother to take the brother around to studios. We just sort of did it really quickly, with our own money. And there's things that would be better if we had more money and more time. But to get more money and more time, you always have to give something else up, which is control over the picture. And that's, after doing Baby It's You, that's just something I didn't want to do. I pretty much let it be known that I didn't want to direct anything unless I had final cut and casting control in my contract. And, I had a executive at one of the studios who I actually like say to me, look, if we gave it to you, we'd have to give it to anybody. And they're right. You know, I've never made them that much money. So it's a precedent that they just don't want to set.
Most of The Brother from Another Planet is shot on location in Harlem. Mm-hmm. Did you have to do any community public relations before setting up the film there? Because recently there have been several instances where people in communities have been very upset with the way they've been treated by the filmmakers and have tried to, you know, boycott the opening of the movie. I don't know that you should have expected a reaction like that, but how did you lay the groundwork for being there so you'd get a good reaction?
Yeah, we didn't do it in any very organized fashion. One of the, we had some people who lived up there, who worked on the film, who were good as liaison people. Randy Fraser, who plays a small part in the film, is a guy who's acted up there and directed up there and all kinds of things, and he was one of our location scouts. And he helped us with knowing, you know, getting in with a lot of our location, you know, locations and places to put up the crew while we were shooting and that kind of thing. Basically, we just made sure that all the people working on the film were aware that we were guests in a community and not the usual film crew who comes in and thinks they can take over. And, you know, everybody should bend over backwards just because you're a film company, you know. So we really, I wanted definitely to make Harlem a character in the movie. We certainly weren't a big enough crew or a powerful enough crew to shut the place down and make everybody get off the streets and then repopulate it with actors playing the residents of Harlem. So in a lot of cases, you know, almost everybody out of focus and even a few people in focus are just residents of Harlem who happened to be going about their business while we were shooting there. So we were able to retain a bit of a documentary feeling to the street scenes and things like that, which is something that I wanted. But basically it was really one-on-one kind of diplomacy, and people were really nice and very gracious, and so it was a lot of fun to shoot up there. You know, we got the title from the movie because we were going through a lot of different title ideas, and you know, finally our production assistants, when people would come up and say, "What's this shooting over here?" and they say, "Well, it's about this brother from another planet," and "Oh, I'll go see that," you know, and so pretty soon the movie became The Brother from Another Planet.
You've acted in most of your movies. In Return of the Sokka 7, you play someone who never left the town that the college is set in, and you now have a family and are very financially strapped. In Liana, you play a very obnoxious teacher. I think you're
right,
a teacher,
right?
Who's
teacher.
Always trying to make it with Liana, being really crude. In The Brother from Another Planet, you play one of the extraterrestrial bounty hunters, one of the men in black. In a way, all the roles that you've played in your own movies are either unsavory or outsiders. Is that intentional? How do you cast yourself?
Well, I basically act in movies that I make because I like to act. It's something that has always helped my writing and vice versa. It really helps me to look at a screenplay and basically in my head play all the parts. I realize, okay, if I was an actor and I had to play this, would I know what I was doing? Would I know why I'm here? You know, what my relationship to this other character is? The outsiders or you know, the outsider basically kind of character is because while I'm directing, I really don't have the time to work with the other actors that much to play somebody who's known people for years or been in a relationship for years or whatever. So I tend to take a smaller part who can just sort of come on and do their business and have whatever meeting they have with the sort of central characters and then step out. It's just I think the people who have directed themselves in lead parts successfully generally are people who have one persona that they play time and again, you know, Clint Eastwood or Woody Allen or, you know, Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin. They basically had a persona which sort of took care of themselves and they weren't playing different characters. And in that, I'm more interested in sort of character acting kind of stuff and playing different kinds of people. I sort of prefer to limit it to pretty small roles and people who are sort of out of the mainstream of the lives of the main characters.
Are there any values that you have now as a filmmaker that you think as you get older and as you become more well-known that you're in danger of compromising?
Mm. I get the chance to make movies so rarely that I don't get much chance to compromise my values. And the values I started with are I don't think that they're not that hard to hold on to, as long as, my final purpose has always been to make movies that I like and that I think other people will like and that I would want to go to. It hasn't been to make Hollywood movies or big budget movies or movies that gross over a certain amount of dollars. And I've always tried to be honest with investors, if we've gotten other investors, and not make something that's definitely going to lose money. I've always tried to, make something for a price that particular movie, being realistic about it, can at least gross this much and people have a good chance of breaking even and some chance of making a profit. So I really haven't had much of that kind of problem.
One last question. Some people really believe that working with frugal budgets keeps you creative. What do you think? You've certainly had a lot of experience doing that.
Having some limitations helps keep you creative. When you can shoot 360-degree coverage and do anything you want and shoot endlessly, you have to have an awful lot of self-discipline, whereas sometimes the outside. But all my movies would have been better if I had more money and more time. I always look at them and I say, at the time I'm shooting them, I know they could be better.
That was filmmaker John Sayles, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical director for today's show was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Maeve McGoran and co-produced by Danny Miller and me. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.